Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome back to the second half of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling. As I mentioned in the first half, we're going to be joined here now in the second half by Dr. Stephen Meyer. Dr. Meyer is the author of Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design. He's also the director of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. He has a brand new book out that was just released on June 18th by Harper One. And Darwin's Doubt is the title of that book, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. In this book, Dr. Meyer, he argues that the mysterious features of the Cambrian explosion, that abrupt appearance of animals in the ancient fossil record, are better explained by intelligent design than purely undirected evolutionary processes. With that, Dr. Meyer, welcome back to the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Well, thanks for having me back, Kevin.
Dr. Meyer, thank you very much for writing this book. It's very interesting, but we better start first maybe by explaining what is the Cambrian period or the Cambrian explosion.
Yeah, that's a great place to start because it also helps explain the title. The Cambrian explosion is the geologically sudden or abrupt appearance in the fossil record of the major groups of animals, the first major groups of animals. And this was something that perplexed Darwin himself in his great work, The Origin of Species. He thought he'd explained every clue but this one. And he found this puzzling because his mechanism of natural selection was something that needed a lot of time to work. He envisioned natural selection acting on small incremental variations, and that these minute variations would accumulate small changes over large periods of time. And instead, what he knew about the fossil record and what others at the time knew was that the first major groups of animals appeared very suddenly, not in a gradual way, as his theory dictated. So that's the mystery. And what I do in the book is I tell the story of that doubt and what's become of it. And I show that the mystery has deepened and intensified, and it's actually grown up to be illustrative of a major problem in evolutionary biology, one that evolutionary biologists themselves are recognizing, and that is the problem of the origin of form generally, the origin of biological form and structure as it arises in the fossil record. The Cambrian is the most dramatic example of that problem, but there are other instances in the history of life where you have the same kind of problem arising.
Mm-hmm. I remember Dr. Berlinski in the Truth Project, where part of the discussion was about those small incremental changes that you just discussed. And I think that this was the point in the Truth Project where he said that he had done some back-of-the-envelope calculations, and from one species to another, there would be, you know, very, very conservatively 40,000 different changes that would have to take place from something that was in the ocean to something that could go on land and so forth.
Sorry to interrupt. He was talking about the whale evolution, and that is indeed a tremendously difficult problem. And based on some superficial resemblances of skeletons in the fossil record, many Darwinian, neo-Darwinian evolutionists have concluded that the whale sequence is one of their poster children. It's one of the best examples of transitional forms, but there's a deeper problem, which Berlinski points out, and that is as you begin to look at the anatomical changes that we know must have taken place to get from a land-dwelling mammal to a mammal that could be fully adapted to life in the ocean, you end up with an enormous number of changes just by observing the anatomy, the anatomical differences of the closest land and sea mammals.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates an engineering problem. And that's really the second mystery that I address with the Cambrian animals. The first mystery is the mystery of the missing ancestral fossils. There's no fossil sequence that accounts for the sudden appearance of the Cambrian animals at the very lowest layers in the geological column documenting animal life. But the second mystery is the same mystery that Berlinski was talking about. How do you build an animal like from something simpler? How do you get all these new anatomical systems? And what we now know is that you need a lot of genetic information and also other forms of information that scientists are now calling epigenetic information. And that's the real mystery. If you're going to build a trilobite or a fish or an echinoderm or any of these animal forms that first arise in the fossil record so suddenly, you have to have a lot of information because biological systems are made of organs and tissues, and those organs and tissues require specific types of cells, and those specific types of cells require, in turn, dedicated proteins of certain specialized types, and every new protein is built with new genetic information. So the Cambrian explosion or other explosions in the history of life where you find new form and structure are actually explosions of information.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the crucial problem. And that's why, and I explain in the book for many reasons that there are many reasons to doubt that the neo-Darwinian mechanism of mutations in natural selection can generate that information.
Mm. Maybe we should also mention what's the difference between the pre-Cambrian and the Cambrian period. How should we think about those in layman terms?
Well, if you just think of the basic concepts of geology, which we probably encountered in eighth grade earth science or high school or, you know, college somewhere along the way, the sedimentary rocks stack up in layers. And all other things being equal, geologists assume that the older ones are usually on the bottom and the younger ones are on the top. And so there's a point in the history of life where, there's a point in the history of life, but also in the geological column, where as you move up the column, you suddenly start finding animal forms. And that layer corresponds to the period of geologic time that is known as the Cambrian. Beneath that layer is the pre-Cambrian period. And so these are just, in a way, arbitrary names that have been assigned to the different layers of sedimentary rock. The pre-Cambrian period is vast in its expanse, thousands of feet of rock, and it represents great stretches of time. And only in the very late pre-Cambrian do we find any animals. And we find just three of the forms. There are 23 animal, what are called phyla, the largest divisions of animal life in the Cambrian. In the very late pre-Cambrian, we find three of those. The other 20 have no discernible ancestors in the pre-Cambrian rock at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the three that do arise in the late pre-Cambrian arise very suddenly themselves and have no discernible connection to the other 20. And so there's the suddenness of the explosion of life is really dramatic all the way around.
Hmm.
Of animal life, yeah.
Right, so we have this tremendous amount of geology of rock that's there. There's nothing in it, or we can't find much of anything, if anything, in it at all. Suddenly there's this period, this is where the explosion word comes from, there's this period in the geology where all of a sudden we see all kinds of different life, fossilized life, in existence during that period of time. Is that
exactly? And okay. In the book, I've got pictures and drawings of all these different creatures. Some of them look very exotic to our eyes today because they've since gone extinct. But even the ones that are extinct exemplify what are called body plans, ways of organizing body parts and tissues that are with us to this day. They're and this is what a phylum represents. It's a unique way of organizing body parts. So, for example, the arthropods first arise in the Cambrian period. We don't have the most distinctive Cambrian arthropod with us anymore, a trilobite. In fact, I much lament. I loved trilobite fossils when I was a little boy. I was fascinated by them.
You're the first one on the broadcast.
We have all kinds of them. We've got crustaceans, shrimps, and crab, and all kinds of crabs and other kinds of arthropods. Arthropods are characterized by their hard exoskeleton. And just contrast the logic of a body with built with a hard exoskeleton to one with an internal skeleton like we have. And the first so-called chordate with an internal notochord appeared in the Cambrian. In fact, we now know that fish first appeared all the way back to the Cambrian. This is a, it was a dramatic discovery in China recently. So it's a really amazing event in the history of life, and one that isn't, you know, Darwin thought of it as, he had a doubt about it, but he thought of it as kind of minor anomaly that future fossil discoveries would resolve by revealing those pre-Cambrian ancestral forms. But they haven't turned up, and instead what's turned up are more exotic Cambrian creatures, each of which themselves lacks ancestral precursors in the lower strata. And so the explosion has become more explosive from a geologic point of view, but it's also become more explosive from a biological point of view, in that we've learned much more about the inner workings of cells and animals and the information that is required. We realize that the Cambrian explosion is also an explosion of information.
Well, let me remind our listening audience, we're speaking with Dr. Stephen Meyer about his latest book called Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. That's put out by Harper One, and so you can find out more information about how you can get a copy of that book. I think a new T-shirt should come out from the Discovery Institute, where Dr. Myers, of course, works and heads up the Discovery Institute. It should say, "I love trilobites." I think that would make a great first one on the broadcast.
It looks like the nerds we really are, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And, Doctor, I wanted to ask you about the fact that Darwin knew that this was a big problem. This is where we get into Darwin's dilemma or Darwin's doubt. But he felt that the problem was just one that we don't have enough data, that there hadn't been enough work done about digging up these fossils. Now that 150 years has taken place in between there, and we've dug up a lot more fossils, and there's been all this great discoveries made, has that solved this problem?
As I mentioned, it has intensified it, actually. The pre-Cambrian ancestral forms have not turned up, despite extensive investigations. And what has turned up is this plethora of new animal forms in the Cambrian. So there are more forms. And as we've been able to date the explosion, and particularly the seams in the rock where the majority of the forms first arise, the time period that is covered has shortened. And so the explosion looks more explosive. But the main way that scientists or paleontologists have tried to explain away the missing ancestral fossils is an idea that has the title of the artifact hypothesis. And it's the idea that we're missing the ancestral Precambrian forms. They don't appear to be there because it's an artifact of our incomplete sampling of the fossil record or an incomplete preservation in the Precambrian. That maybe there was something in the depositional environment that made it unfavorable for preserving these animals. And the main idea that the most plausible version of that has said that the reason that these forms didn't turn up is they were either too small or too soft. They didn't have hard parts. The rudimentary forms of the Cambrian animals would have lacked hard parts. Well, there's an amazing find in China that started in the 80s, and then there's been a series of discoveries at this place called or near Chengjiang, a city in southern China. It's a fantastic Cambrian find that the animals are preserved with almost photographic realism. And I've got some pictures of them in the book in color. They're just gorgeous fossils. But the really extraordinary thing is another find in China where several paleontologists have identified embryonic fossils, small embryo fossils, of soft-tissued sponge embryos. And this raises a huge question because it shows that the depositional environment was fully capable of preserving both small and soft-bodied animals.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the animals with any discernible connection to the 20 phyla that I mentioned, the animals representing the 20 phyla that I mentioned, are just not there. So if you can preserve an embryo and the soft-tissued embryo, why aren't you preserving the ancestral forms of those 20 animal phyla that are missing such ancestors in the fossil record. It shows that the record was capable, the depositional environment was capable of preserving things, but that they're not preserved suggests that they just weren't there, and the explosion is a real event. It's not an artifact of bad sampling or bad preservation.
And we also see, I guess, when you're talking about China, the other points, I think we were speaking about Canada and other discoveries that were made there and so forth. This is a worldwide event.
It's a worldwide event in the history of life. It's extraordinary. Absolutely. Yeah, the Burgess Shale in Canada is another wonderful place. And the last chapter of the book, I tell the story of my own little expedition up there with a number of geologists and geophysicists and marine biologists with my son, and of an interesting conversation we had with our guide on the way down the hill. All of the scientists were skeptical of Darwinism and knew about the Cambrian and were excited about what it pointed to as far as evidence of design. But our guide was, of course, assigned to us by the local foundation that is allowed to run the hikes, and he was giving us the full-blown Darwinian party line, and in a gentle way. But he was saying that the Cambrian, as he was giving the talks, he was talking about how it supported evolutionary theory. And one of the boys on the trip raised the question with him that we were all trying to avoid. We knew how sensitive the topic was with scientists, and we just wanted to see the fossils and not get into a big argument. And one of the boys asked him, "Well, why do you think that the Cambrian explosion supports Darwinian theory? How does that work?" And the guide said something vague about it showing, change over time. You know, the life had changed over time, which is a minimalist definition of evolution that pretty much everyone accepts. Of course, and the boy said, "Well, of course, life changes over time, but it didn't change in a sudden Darwinian way," he said. And how do you explain the sudden appearance of all these body plants? So they got in quite an argument, but it was a friendly one, and the guide was very patient with this boy who was just, rushing in where angels fear to tread.
Right.
But near the end of the, halfway down the mountain, the guide started engaging several of us in the conversation, and at the end he said, he had had doubts about some of these same doubts, and though he was committed to the evolutionary perspective, he was also really uncomfortable with a view of life that denied any purpose. So I explained our case for intelligent design based on the information explosion, because what we know from experience is that information always arises from an intelligent source. One scientist, an information theorist who was applying information theory to molecular biology, said that information is habitually associated with conscious activity. And so I explained to him our idea that if you have an explosion of information, what we know from experience, uniform and repeated experience, which geologists recognize as the basis of all reasoning about the past, then you're looking at evidence of a designing mind, not just a material process. So he expressed intrigue with that idea, and we sent him some things after the hike.
You write in the book about why this is so important, the significance of it. And one of the areas in your book that I thought was interesting to get back to make sure that we have a firm understanding of this, is why this matters for science. You were just talking a lot about information, about data that we receive. We've got to look at the data honestly, right? And looking at the data honestly, we've got to allow the data to take us where the data leads or points to.
Right, exactly. There's a kind of convention in science. I wouldn't call it a method. It's not a method. It's an arbitrary convention that says that if you're going to be a scientist, you have to limit yourself to strictly materialistic explanations. And the convention has a fancy name. It's called methodological naturalism. And many scientists regard the observance of this convention is a kind of duty that they must hold to. And so this is why the book was reviewed over or at the end of last week in the New Yorker, an elite journal of Northeast secular liberal opinion, and a very prestigious journal. Of course, the New Yorker reviewed the book negatively, but it gave it a number of backhanded compliments, one of which was that it was a masterwork, and then he said, of pseudoscience. And he acknowledged that the book was serious and that was, you know, that I came off as reasonable and all of that. But, and so I wondered, well, why is the book pseudoscience if it's, if the argument is reasonable and I'm familiar with the science and it's written in a, you know, way that he thought was engaging, blah, blah, blah. Well, the reason it's pseudoscience is it breaks this rule. It breaks this convention by inferring that an intelligence, a designer was responsible for the origin of the information necessary to build these animals. And in other words, I broke the rule of limiting scientific hypothesizing to strictly materialistic explanations. But that's an entirely reasonable thing to do in this case because of what we know from our uniform and repeated experience.
Mm-hmm.
If information isn't the kind of thing that arises by materialistic processes. If you go to the British Museum and you see the Rosetta Stone, you don't look at all those etchings on the rock in the three different languages and say, oh, gee, isn't it wonderful what wind and erosion did? Because we know that wind and erosion and other material processes don't generate information. But we do know, based on our experience, that that minds generate information. And so the logical thing to infer is that a mind was responsible for those etchings, for that information. And I'm arguing the same thing, the same kind of reasoning should be permitted when we're looking at life. We should follow the evidence where it leads. And when we're looking at information, the evidence leads to intelligence, to what we call intelligent design, to a mind.
Mm-hmm. You got a last segment here in the book, or one of the last segments, where it speaks about what's at stake. And the last line in here, and I think that this is so important to mention, especially to the audience, our audience here on Knowing Truth radio broadcast, to Christians, that that we don't need to be afraid of the data. The data is not our enemy. The data is actually our friend. You write this: the theory of intelligent design is not based upon religious belief, nor does it provide a proof for the existence of God. But it does have faith-affirming implications, precisely because it suggests that the design we observe in the natural world is real, just as traditional theistic view of the world would lead us to expect. And so Christians don't need to be afraid of this, right? We can look at the data honestly, because ultimately the data points to a designer, and then in Christian theology we see who that designer actually is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, not all advocates of intelligent design are Christians, for the simple reason that you don't have to be a Christian to see the evidence of intelligent design.
Mm-hmm.
But Christians and the whole Judeo-Christian tradition affirms that the world is the product of a designing mind, namely the mind of God. And so evidence of design is precisely what we should expect to see. And I happen to be a Christian, even though I work with a number of scientists who also see the evidence of design, or who doubt Darwinism, who are not Christians. So as a Christian, I also think that I think we should look at the world with the expectation that what we see in the created order should also support what we know about the world and about God from Scripture, because there's an ancient metaphor that was used back in the Middle Ages and into the Reformation times of the two books. There's the book of nature and there's the book of Scripture, and it is the assumption of people of faith that the two would ultimately agree. And one of the exciting, I think, implications of the work that I've done on these two books, or the research that I've done in these books, is that they do.
Mm-hmm.
there is evidence of design just as people of faith should expect to see. So I make the case that the theory of intelligent design is based on evidence. It's an inference from biological data, not an interpretation of Scripture. But the inference from the data supports what we would expect to be the case based on faith. So it's that's why I say it's not a proof for God's existence, but it certainly has theistic implications. And whereas the Darwinian view of things, I think, has implications that support a materialistic worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the reasons that there's such a spirited discussion. People realize that there's a lot of things at stake for science. You approach science differently if you think it was if life was designed as opposed to the result of an undirected process. But there's also implications for larger worldview questions.
Mm-hmm.
And That's why I think it's, I said at the end of the book, that that's not a reason to believe in intelligent design.
Right.
But having accepted it for other reasons, it may be a reason to think of it to realize that it's important.
Dr. Meyer, thank you so much for writing this book. Thank you so much for being with us today on the program. We really appreciate the work there at the Discovery Institute. That's www.discovery.org. You can find out more about the book. Thanks again. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kevin. Yeah, you bet.
Okay, that was Dr. Stephen Meyer. And as I mentioned, you can go out to their website. Their website is www.discovery.org in order to find out more about Dr. Meyer and more about Darwin's Doubt, the book that we're talking about today on the program. We'll see you again here tomorrow on the broadcast. Remember this, the Lord Jesus Christ said, He said, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. We'll see you next time, right here on Knowing the Truth.
You've been listening to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. For more information about the church and radio ministry, visit us on the web at knowingthetruth.org.
The opinions expressed on today's program are those of the announcers, their guests, and callers, and do not necessarily represent those of the staff and management of His Radio Network, the Radio Training Network, or Clear Channel Communications.